Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 17th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. We'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle and Ed Miller at the Provincetown Independent. We'll speak with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Jack Spillane at the Standard Times in New Bedford, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Mike Dean up at the State House. Now here's a look at some of the top stories around the region. We're joined at the start by WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and WCAI's Eve Zuckoff. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Good to be here.
And hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
The role of police in our communities has been part of a wider discussion these past weeks after the death of George Floyd at the hands of Minneapolis police. Last night in Falmouth, the group No Place for Hate hosted a public forum on policing in the town. Jeanette, you covered this. What was the goal here and who was involved?
Yeah, so the goal was to answer any questions that people might have in the community about the practices of the police department, which of course is in light of everything that's going on nationally, and to create kind of a sense of transparency in the community about how the Falmouth police operate. Police Chief Edward Dunn became kind of the focus of the panel in a sense because most of the questions were directed to him. The moderator was Marie Younger Blackburn. Other members of the panel, they had the Reverend Will Bevan of St. Barnabas Episcopal Church in Falmouth, Megan English Braga, who is of course, the select board chair. They had Anjali Scott Price of Mizar Imaging and Bill Huff, who is the publisher of Enterprise Newspapers.
So what kinds of questions were fielded here?
Well, people asked about how the department feels about things like qualified immunity, how the chief feels about qualified immunity, about the idea of perhaps bringing more social services to bear in policing to help people, because the chief did talk about the very large number of calls that involve some kind of either mental health or substance issue. They asked about how police are trained to de-escalate a situation, about diversity in the department, and also about how the chief and the department view immigrants in the community.
And what did they hear? What were our takeaways from this?
Well, the chief said that equity and protecting everyone ethically in the community really is kind of the focus of their mission. He said with regard to bringing more social services, he says that he does want to have a civilian clinician in the police department, similar to the way they have the domestic violence advocate. But when he was asked, you know, could actual police funds be redirected to fund that person, he said, well, that person really can't replace a police officer because it's too dangerous for a civilian clinician, counselor, or so forth to go out on police calls. What they do, like with the domestic violence advocate, is to follow up after the initial calls.
Mm. Flood risk in coastal communities is on the rise. A new federal report finds in the next 30 years, communities on the Cape and Islands could see as many as 135 days of coastal flooding each year. Eve, you reported on this. Can you start just by explaining this particular kind of flooding that you say is increasing?
Yes. So this particular kind of flooding is actually called sunny day flooding or high tide flooding. And it's described that way because it's what happens when there's no storm. But the water is rising about 2 feet above the typical daily high tide. And just last year, communities on the Cape and Islands saw 2 days of sunny day flooding. This year, we should expect 3 to 7 days, according to this report from the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration. But then there's that huge leap, as you say. In 30 years, we could see 35 to 135 days of flooding. And basically the reason is that, you know, as climate change warms oceans and melts glaciers, sea levels are rising. And so floods that used to only happen during storms will now happen more often during things like a full moon or a king tide, or really just with a change in winds or currents.
What is there that we can do about this?
Yeah, I'm sorry to say that unfortunately, even with pretty significant cuts to global carbon emissions, this is the trajectory we're on. That's according to the lead author on this report. But there's things we can do to get just to see just 35 days of flooding a year, to stay closer to that. That, you know, that would really involve really seriously reducing our carbon emissions to reduce the worst effects. And also, I think probably more importantly, we can and should use this information to take stock of areas that are already vulnerable to floods. So we have to have conversations about what do we value, what infrastructure needs to be moved or elevated because it's on the coast and it's regularly flooded, and the damage of persistent flooding really it will affect local economies, tourism, and we need to minimize the impacts it has.
Jeanette, the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force, which is helping to manage the local pandemic response this week, highlighted some of the ways that towns have been coping. Mask wearing is a big issue. It's been demonstrated to cut down on virus transmission. Tell us, what did we hear about how towns are dealing with getting people to wear masks?
Right. So as one official characterized it this week from one of the towns, they're really using kind of a gentle reminder approach. And they not, you know, they have these orders or these recommendations, but there's kind of a limit to what they're doing on enforcement. So in Dennis, for example, they have hired additional beach monitors to remind people to wear masks. Selectman Chris Flanagan says most people are complying with that. Over in Chatham, they actually have a $300 fine in place for violating their mask order, which applies to the downtown and certain other popular areas in town. But Shireen Davis of the Board of Selectmen says they're giving people three warnings, and they're focusing on really educating the public and offering masks and talking to people. They have masks that they're, you know, I think at those locations that they're offering to people who don't have them. So, you know, the approach they're taking is really not to be kind of punitive, but seeking cooperation and seeking to educate people on why masks make a difference.
Now, at the same time, State Senator Julian Sears says there's some concern around new COVID cases around the Cape and Islands.
Oh, yes. He says he's concerned because there are some new COVID cases popping up in Harwich and Provincetown that are specifically connected to the restaurant and hospitality industry. And he feels like if it becomes a trend, an upward trend that's visible after this coming Saturday, which is the 14-day mark since the 4th of July, if the trend continues, we may have to reconsider whether we actually have indoor dining. He says that that could be something that is part of that trend if it turns out to be a trend. So we had a few more cases this week, but he says it's really not an uptick yet.
Eve Zuckoff, you are our environmental reporter, and that means it isn't often you get to talk about good news. But this week you did. There was an effort at the state level to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector. Tell us about that.
Yes, and thank you for the acknowledgement. On Tuesday, Massachusetts joined 14 other states with the commitment to accelerate the market for large electric vehicles. So why this is good news is it means that we're going to see more trucks and buses on the roads powered by electricity in the thousands. So the goal really is in 30 years, 100% of pickup trucks, delivery trucks, big rigs, school transit buses in these states will be powered by electricity, not producing harmful air pollutants, producing, you know, zero carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. And environmental groups are saying this is a huge step in the right direction because the transportation sector generates by far the largest share of our state's greenhouse gas emissions and a really large share of the national greenhouse gas emissions.
How likely is this that it could work?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, this is the work of 15 states, including New York, New Jersey, California, most of the New England states. So even if the goals aren't met, this is a clear commitment by states saying they're going to try, especially as the federal government is rolling back some really forward-moving climate change protections. And so to actually more directly answer your question of is this actually possible, this goal will be hard to achieve, given existing technology, and more than that, how much that technology costs at the moment. So states will probably look more towards electrifying school buses first, where the tech is a little bit further ahead. It's easier to manage a fleet like that. They'll probably do that before they work on big rigs. And ultimately, we will know more in 6 months when a plan is expected to be released. And I bet you I will be back here talking about incentive programs, fleet mandates, and outreach plans that the states are probably developing as we speak.
That was WCAI's Eve Zuckoff, and we spoke with Jeanette Barnes. Eve and Jeanette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. Thank you, Steve.
The state is laying out its plans to replace the Bourne and Sagamore bridges. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times has that story and joins us now. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Mr. Junker. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ethan, you had the opportunity to have a conversation with folks from the State Department of Transportation. What did you hear about a timeline for all of this?
For folks that don't know, the Bourne and Sagamore bridges are federally owned by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and an agreement was made that the state would kind of lead construction and take over the two new bridges that are expected to be built. The Corps initially laid out a plan where construction on the Sagamore could start by 2025. MassDOT basically said they're hoping to be on that same schedule, although that could be pretty hard depending on permitting and funding.
So how does this work look like it's going to proceed? Is the state is in charge here, and they're going to sort of pick up the ball that the Army Corps had been moving along? They did a big draft report, the Army Corps. Are they just going to move this forward from where the Army Corps left it?
Yeah, that's kind of how it's going to work. They're going to be working together, but this is going to go away. A lot of MassDOT projects kind of go where there is kind of like a three-phase thing to get you to construction. So there is a preliminary design, which we are in the very initial steps of that. Then it gets to a 25% design, which that kind of lays out the really big picture details of what the project would look like. And then it gets turned over to a design and building firm, which kind of fleshes everything out and gets it to the point where shovels start to go into the ground.
I guess the biggest question still out there is how is this going to get paid for? And they still don't really know that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's obviously a huge question, and that can really throw everything
It's a $1 billion question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so it's about $1 billion, a little over $1 billion estimated for this project. And one of the things where the state said they may be able to do better at this than the federal government is the Army Corps is more of a watersway. They don't have that many traffic bridges. MassDOT said, oh, we do bridges a lot more often. This is more kind of our bailiwick. Let us kind of lead this here and let us take them over. Everybody's looking to try and get this funding from the federal government. Both have kind of said they don't want to turn to the state. But obviously that sparks some fears for future maintenance if these do get built, because these bridges are not cheap to maintain, which kind of leads into the topic of tolls, which is always a huge fear for Cape Codders.
And what do they say about tolls right now, anyway?
MassDOT is saying that tolls are not in the plan at all, something they haven't even been discussing. One of the key things is the Army Corps of Engineers, which also owns the canal, is mandated to maintain free crossings across the canal. That is something that, to change that, you would need a congressional act. So that's a pretty big ask. When these bridges do get handed over to the state has no such mandate, which is something that people fear that one day, if maintenance gets too expensive for new bridges, they could turn to tolls, especially people in Bourne who have to cross that every day.
Hmm. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times joining us. Ethan, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on the Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard has a coronavirus distinction in the state, and it's a good thing. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette has the story. Hiya, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, this is about testing. You've done a great breakdown of numbers here. Tell us about what's going on.
So Martha's Vineyard, sort of surprisingly, has actually tested more patients for the coronavirus than any other town on Cape Cod, including Nantucket and Barnstable, which, you know, a lot of these towns on Cape Cod, at least size-wise, are much larger than six vineyard towns all combined. There is a reason for it, and on the island it might be obvious, but maybe elsewhere it's not. We have this sort of unique, comprehensive, asymptomatic coronavirus testing site. And basically, they've been pushing through at least 200 people a day for the past few weeks. And it's allowed us to have, I think, one of the highest, if not the highest, testing rate in the state, which is kind of cool and exciting.
And what have the numbers been telling people?
Well, they're sort of, you know, I think when people went into it, this was a unique project. No one really knew how it was going to work. And they didn't really know what to expect. And I think the results have, just because there are results, have been illuminating in that sense. It's shown that there are people who carry the virus asymptomatically on the island, but it shows that there are very few of them. I think of the 4,400 and odd people who have been tested at the site, 11 have come back testing positive. That's a positive testing rate of like 0.02%, which is lower than most other places in the state. So I think that was heartening. But, you know, it is still a sign that the virus does, you know, is being carried asymptomatically on the island. And I think actually what's interesting is the first round of testing that happened at the site involved workers for frontline businesses, healthcare workers, that kind of thing. They sort of prioritized testing that way. And all of those tests came back negative. And so it's shown that businesses are responsive to going out and having their employees be tested and to use it as a resource to say, hey, look, we can be open because these people can test and they can test negative. But it's, you know, shown that there still is a chance that people are carrying it, which is interesting. And there's sort of, you know, in some ways, we have sort of a more contained population just because of the island. And so, you know, you can get sort of an interesting sense of the virus's spread, which is unique.
With all this testing available, how easy is it now for people in the Vineyard to get a test?
Well, that's a good question. The availability is widespread. If you're symptomatic, you can get tested at Martha's Vineyard Hospital. If you're asymptomatic, you can get tested at this site. And it's free, and it's available to anyone. And all you have to do is call. But there have been issues with lag times, especially calling the call center. People have had to wait in, you know, what could be two-hour wait times, maybe even longer. I think the people who are running the site have been working to try and alleviate some of those issues. I don't know if they expected the enormous volume. Maybe they did, but, you know, it was something that's never been done before, and so there wasn't really any way to predict how it was going to play out. For instance, they did not know that Mondays were going to be the most popular day for people to call to schedule a test, which, when you think about it, sort of makes sense. But yes, it's available, but there have been sort of wait times, and if you're under 18, you can't get tested at the site, which is something that they're trying to work out, especially with schools thinking about coming back. It would be really beneficial, I think, if kids could get tested as well. So there is widespread availability, but there have been issues with sort of accessibility and getting into the test site, and there's been lag times in getting responses, but overall, it's probably more accessible than almost anywhere.
That is Noah Asmo joining us from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for that.
Thanks.
Stickers promoting a right-wing hate group have been found in Chatham. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with that story. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, tell us, what do we know about these stickers?
Well, the stickers promote a group called the Patriot Front, which is categorized by both the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League as a white nationalist group. Their website talks about reclaiming America from, quote, tyrannical rule of a corrupt state and global plutocracy, unquote. And they seem to be promoting a white European rule of the country. Now, the stickers were found in downtown Chatham on the backs of parking signs and street signs and on telephone poles. A local business owner in the downtown area spotted them and scraped off a bunch of them over the last week. But, you know, I went out to look earlier this week, and there were still a number of them around. And later in the week, the town's DPW did a sweep of downtown and cleaned off all the stickers from the street signs in town.
This has prompted a number of local officials to speak out about these stickers.
Yeah, the stickers and what they stand for were roundly condemned by town officials, by both Senator Julian Cyr and Republican and Representative Sarah Peek. They expressed outrage at this. Reverend Brian McGurk of St. Christopher's Church in downtown Chatham, who has led a number of anti-racist forums in town, he said he was very disturbed by this, and this kind of thing hitting so close to home really, really bothered him. Chamber of Commerce and Local Merchants Association also spoke out against these stickers, and they urged downtown business owners to keep an eye out for anyone putting up these stickers. What we found in our investigation is that this is something that the Patriot Front does. They blanket a town with stickers, flyers, posters. They've been found in other Massachusetts communities, in other Cape towns, so Senator Cyr has told us. Right now, the Chatham police are treating this as a case of vandalism of town signs that carries up to a $300 fine. But Chief of Police Mark Paulina also told us that he's assigned a detective to research the group, reach out to other law enforcement organizations, and find out if these stickers could be considered hate speech. And as part of that investigation, they're going to be tapping local Main Street businesses to see if any have any surveillance tape that might show someone putting up these stickers. And hopefully we'll have a follow-up on this next week to see if they've been able to track anything down.
Mm. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
If you're in need of a job, Provincetown is looking for a new town manager. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us now to tell us why it's been a hard position to fill. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. Ed, the current town manager was in the job for just 6 months, and now she's leaving. Explain what's happening here.
Well, I'll explain it as best I can, because we don't have all the details. But Robin Craver was hired on January 13th of this year by the Provincetown Select Board to be the town manager. The unanimous choice of the select board, who were impressed with her experience. Basically, she had been a town administrator in the town of Charlton, just outside Worcester, for 13 years, and they liked that very much. She got a total compensation of $199,190. In salary, plus a $9,000 housing allowance. She was required to live in Provincetown. And they gave her a three-year contract with a six-month probationary period, so that if she were fired or asked to resign within that 6 months, she would get no severance pay. After 6 months, if that happened, she would get 8 months of salary as a severance, or about $126,000. Well, so her probationary period was expiring on July 13th, which was this week, Monday. And last Thursday, the 9th, the select board met in executive session to discuss her contract and performance. And the next day, there was a joint statement from Ms. Craver and the chair of the select board, Dave Abramson, saying that she had resigned and giving very few details, saying only nice things about each other. So it's back to the drawing board for a job that pays almost $200,000 a year and that no one seems to be able to do.
Well, you spoke to the previous town manager about why this might be a particularly difficult position to fill in. He had some interesting things to say.
Yeah, so that's David Panagor, who was town manager from 2015 to 2019. So he lasted 4 years and then left to become the chief administrator of the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority, though he still lives in Provincetown. David Panagor said, you'll notice no other town administrator on Cape Cod applied for the job. He said, we asked him, you know, what's the problem in Provincetown? And he said a number of things. It's a population that thrives on argument. There's a toxic Facebook culture, and there's open hostility on the select board that make it very hard to be a town manager in Provincetown. He said, quote, free speech is valued in Provincetown and compromise is not. The population values its contentiousness. That's definitely true. There is a tremendously unrestrained amount of vitriolic commentary, especially on social media. One thing that he didn't mention that I think is an issue that is worth looking at, it's really a state issue, not a local issue, and that is this whole business of so-called executive sessions where these problems are discussed. And, of course, that's a euphemism, executive session. What it means is secret session where the press and the public are not allowed. And Ms. Craver left her job in Charlton just a year ago when the Board of Selectmen there bought out her contract for $400,000. And if you look at the news reports from that incident, you'll see the exact same words practically. Everybody saying nothing but, you know, good things about each other. And the buyout of her contract included provisions, you know, preventing anyone from saying anything about what happened. And no one will talk on the record in Provincetown about what went on at last Thursday's select board executive session. But clearly there were some serious issues of management and ability to work with other people. And, you know, maybe those will come out at some point, but they might very well not. And I think it's something to look at. You know, there's all these exceptions to the state's open meeting law, and maybe there are too many.
That is Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks for joining us with that story.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
The Nantucket Select Board has run afoul of open meeting laws. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with the story. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, the Select Board says they did nothing wrong. What's happening here?
Well, what's happening here is that an island resident has filed two open meeting law complaints in the past month against the Select Board, both regarding its appointment of a late applicant to the Conservation Commission over the chairman at the time, and its revote on that appointment a week later. Mary Warrow's first complaint alleges that the board should not have considered Linda Williams' late application since it came in after the published deadline. The board last month appointed Williams to replace Chairwoman Ashley Arisman, and Warrow's second complaint stems from the board's revote a week later, in which it reversed this decision and voted Arisman back onto the commission, but it did not allow public comment before the vote. Waro agreed with the board's decision to revote, saying it righted a wrongdoing by doing so. But she said the larger issue is one of transparency and the public's right to comment on the proceedings of government. The select board did deny violating the open meeting law in either of those instances, arguing in a letter to the state attorney general that it has long had a practice of accepting and sometimes appointing late applicants to boards and commissions. In fact, Erisman's first appointment came when she was a late applicant. That practice has actually been upheld by the state in the past, but when it was upheld, it came with an admonition from the state that it wasn't in the best interest of transparency to continue down that road. Select Board Chairwoman Dawn Holgate also said that the board has long made its appointments without public comment, out of a concern that public criticism of applicants could very well discourage participation in local government. The board's going to discuss their whole public hearing appointment process at its August 5th meeting.
Josh, also on the island, the Airport Commission is agreeing to spend nearly $1 million on additional testing for PFAS in drinking water around the airport. Tell us what's happening.
Sure. This is a story we first reported last week. Eight homes near the airport on Mattakesham Valley Road tested positive last month for those potentially cancer-causing chemicals known as PFAS, and that they were believed to that chemicals believed to have come from flame retardant foam used at Nantucket Memorial Airport during firefighting exercises. Four of those homes received filtration systems from the town, and four did not. On Tuesday, the Airport Commission did approve a $963,000 contract with its environmental and planning consultant to install filtration systems at the four homes that did not have them, and then do additional extensive testing on another 23 properties west of the airport. They have about $500,000 in their coffers to do this work, and then they need the select board to request permission from the state DOR to spend the rest of the money with an emergency authorization. Neighbors and residents around the airport not very happy right now. Surfside Homeowners Association president, who lives nearby, said he doubts that 23 additional tests will be enough to quell the fear that the residents have about what's going on with their drinking water. Many of the Surfside residents learned of the positive tests by reading the paper, he said. They've reached out to the airport and the health department and are having a hard time getting information. He actually compared the situation to what's going on with coronavirus. He said it's hard to know how concerned people should be if there isn't any testing, and there should be a lot more. The Airport Commission chairman, however, says that he'd like to see the testing conducted in rounds. So start with the 23 homes closest to the airport and then move further out. Some other airport commissioners, however, and environmental leaders and residents say that's not enough. They want much further extensive testing to sort of get a handle on how much contamination there is out there and then work their way back in instead of working their way in to out.
Mm. That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. A long unsolved murder is getting a closer look in New Bedford. Jack Spillane of the Standard Times has the story for us. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Steve.
Jack, this is about the murder of Jack Perry in 1975. Tell us about this case.
Well, it was a case that really stumped police even back then. This was a young gentleman who had everything going for him. He was 21 years old, recently married, was going to college, was employed. He had no known connections to previous crimes. His body was found out at New Bedford Airport, very badly beaten to death. And at the he was a Cape Verdean man. At the time, there was some feeling in the community that murders of people of color did not get the attention of white middle-class victims. So the case was never solved. And last week, District Attorney Thomas Quinn announced that he was going to reopen it. He didn't say that he had some new piece of evidence, just that he has an ongoing effort to reopen cold cases that have never been solved.
One of the things you do in the article is reached out to the family of Jack Perry and kind of went back through the Standard Times archive as well about some of the coverage of this over the years. And it really brings to life the impact this had for this family of this unsolved murder hanging out there.
Yes, our reporter, Karen Dunlop, did a wonderful job of talking to the family, some of whom who live out of state now, about just what this murder did to them. There were five children, and She talked to two of the sisters, and they basically said that the murder destroyed the family, particularly their mother, who had raised them, never recovered. They said there was just – they, at the time that it happened, thought, well, of course it will be solved, thinking that murders get solved. But as the years went by and it didn't, one of the sisters described it as like a scab that never healed for the family. And it wasn't until the mother finally died in 2012 that they the siblings talked about, again, how they would like to see the case solved. It was very strange. His body, he both had his wedding ring and cash on him, so it was not robbery. No one has ever really understood what happened to Jack Perry.
There is a feeling that the police expressed the feeling that there could be a witness out there or somebody who has information, and by going public this way, they're hoping that somebody's going to be able to respond and give them some information about the case.
Yes, that is frequently the issue with cold cases, is that there is a witness out there who may know something. We saw this a few years ago with a gangland-styled murder in New Bedford, in which they reopened it, and they eventually did solve it, not so much from a witness, but just through evidence that had been around and people taking a second look at it. They're hoping someone will come forward. As I said, they did not say they had anything in particular that would lead them to know what happened, but they're hoping somebody will come forward.
Jack, this is part of there are other cases as well, part of a kind of a larger effort here for the DA's office.
Yes. Both District Attorney Thomas Quinn and his predecessor, Sam Sutter, have emphasized cold cases that have not been solved. I think you have to remember that 45 years ago, you did not have the DNA analysis and the forensic detective work that can be done now. Of course, in this case, it's difficult because the victim's wife, who the family is not in touch with, does no longer has the wedding ring. It's not clear what happened to it, and a few other artifacts that she received at the time of the murder. So it will be interesting to see if they can solve it.
That is Jack Spillane talking to us from the Standard Times in New Bedford. Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
Should Martha's Vineyard have a uniform island-wide policy on mask wearing? Seems like a simple question. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us to explain why there isn't a simple answer. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Yeah, nothing is simple.
George, the county commissioners are proposing an island-wide policy that could include fines for people not wearing masks. Each of the towns is having its own conversation about this. Explain what's happening here.
Yeah, you know, it's always a good time to remind people that it's Martha's Vineyard, but there are six separate towns there, and they all have their own governments and make their own decisions. They did work pretty well together early on in the pandemic, coming up with some policies on stay-at-home orders and construction bans. But lately, it's been hard to find consensus on a mandatory mask order. Edgartown has imposed one, and now Oak Bluffs yesterday imposed one as well. But the Dukes County Commission would like an island-wide one. They say it's, you know, it does no good for each of the towns to have these separate mandatory mask orders, you know, unless all of them are doing it. And so far, the other towns have not joined in, although it appears like West Tisbury may as soon as next week.
What is some of the reluctance for that energy just to have an island-wide stance?
Yeah, it's hard to say exactly. You know, they haven't been working that well together in recent weeks, you know, and I think it might be just resources, you know, the island boards of health, you know, sort of taking the charge, taking the lead here. And they're just overwhelmed. You can tell because we found on a website, the Island Boards of Health website earlier this week, they were actually promoting no mask wearing dating back to early March. We all remember early on, folks were saying, you know, we shouldn't be wearing masks. That was all about the lack of PPE. And now, you know, it's been very clear from the CDC on down, the governor saying that mask wearing helps stop the spread of COVID-19.
George, I want to ask you about another story you had in the paper this week, a really interesting story about a former Tisbury police officer alleging discrimination in the workplace.
Yeah, I'm going to start out by saying this is a complicated story, so we're not going to be able to talk about it in too much detail, but this is Kyndia Roman. She's a former Tisbury police sergeant. She says she was harassed while she was with the department for being a Hispanic gay woman. When she tried to leave the department to go to work for another department off island, she says she was sabotaged by a member of the Tisbury Police Department calling them and saying things about her partner. So it's a complicated story. It involves an MCAD complaint and also a federal lawsuit involving her former boss, Lieutenant Meisner, who says he was let go by the department because he stood up for her.
Let me ask you one more question. I just want to circle back onto the mask issue. And
sure.
We even heard this week a little bit about the Steamship Authority kind of upping their game in trying to get people to wear masks. It just seems part of this whole conversation that's happening on the island.
Absolutely. So there was an incident on the on one of the ferry buses where two people were wearing a mask and two people weren't, and there was a confrontation between them. The SSA didn't step in at the time, and a lot of people were disappointed about that on the island. Our comment section really lit up on that. Now the SSA is saying they're going to enforce the policy, and if people won't put on their masks, they're even willing to call in the state police or local police to enforce it. That's how serious they are about it now.
Well, it does seem if they're trying to think about a comprehensive policy for mask wearing on the island, even arriving on the island, as many people do by ferry, that's kind of the place you want to start that conversation.
Absolutely. And, you know, the ferry, the SSA does have a lot of signage up encouraging mask wearing. It is an order of the governor that on transportation like ferries, like buses, you must be wearing a mask. The Steamship Authority does allow you to take your mask off if you're sitting outside on a nice day. But inside the ferry, people should be wearing their masks. It's all about respect for other people. This is about, you know, not spreading the virus yourself, because, you know, I think you can't say it enough that people who are asymptomatic can spread this virus. You don't have to be showing symptoms in order to spread it.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times joining us. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Steve.
A major police reform bill came out of the state Senate this week and now heads to the House. Earlier, I spoke with our state House reporter Mike Dean about that and other news from Beacon Hill. Here's our conversation. Hi, Mike.
Hey, how are you, Steve?
Mike, tell us about this police reform bill. What's in it and who got what they wanted or didn't?
It's a very big bill. It's what we call omnibus legislation here on Beacon Hill, and it kind of glommed together a whole bunch of other bills and other initiatives and priorities into this one giant and kind of very ambitious piece of legislation. I could say the foundation of it is Governor Baker's bill that he filed, I believe, last month that would create a kind of oversight committee, a new mechanism for overseeing the police and accrediting them, much in the way that, you know, teachers and other public employees have an accreditation that can be rescinded if they, you know, abuse their power or, you know, violate kind of standards or things like that. And it would also standardize a lot of training that police in every department across the state would get. That's kind of the foundation of it. The House actually strengthened that to have a stronger committee, a more, you know, open and community-faced, I guess is the way to put it, a committee that would kind of run that oversight, but then it does a ton more. The main piece of friction in the Senate when they debated this, which I should say was the debate was delayed several days by Republicans, and then finally on Monday night, well into Tuesday morning, the bill passed at around 4:30 a.m. They passed this bill. Much of the debate that night was concerning qualified immunity, which is protections that police and other state employees have against civil lawsuits that might come up during the course of their jobs. Police do not want any limitations to their qualified immunity standards that they already enjoy right now. A lot of police unions and individual police were reaching out to senators to make their point about this. It stayed in the bill. The limitations on it stayed in the bill. However, when it comes to the House now, which should be taken up as early as next week, a lot of police organizations say that they are going to be very vocal when that bill is heard in the House.
Mm. So what does happen next? You say it goes to the House. What kind of time frame is there for this as the lawmakers, they're heading to a recess in a couple of weeks?
A very truncated timeline by Beacon Hill standards, certainly. Speaker DeLeo said that he's going to actually hold a hearing, a public hearing, virtual, of course, on the bill as early as this week to go over it in the way that he says, and a lot of critics say, the Senate did not. So that's something that it's going to go through the House process as it is quite rapidly so that they can take it up next week. This is where a lot of those police unions say that they want to make changes, they want to have their voice heard, and things like that. Yes, you're right that they're going to recess in a few weeks, and actually the legislature, the Democrats who are in charge, have now essentially passed the point where they can override any of Governor Baker's vetoes. It is now so close to the deadline, the governor, a Republican, of course, can stall legislation to the point where the Democrats in the legislature will have recessed and can no longer address it. So that is a huge piece of power that the Democrats have now ceded to the Republican governor. And when it comes to issues like this, where the governor may be at odds with more liberal Democrats in the legislature, that's a huge dynamic that the House is probably going to deal with. So you will likely come out with something that is palatable by all parties, that Baker can sign, that they won't need to override. And that might not be extremely acceptable to some of the more progressive activists who are behind the Senate bill.
Also this week, Mike, the governor announced a new telephone number for people to call to report concerns about businesses that may not be following the proper pandemic safety guidelines. Tell us about this.
Yeah, the state is essentially going to expand the 211 system, which is kind of the state information guideline. Think 411 for telephone numbers, 311. A lot of municipalities use that to hook up services and get in touch with their constituents and residents. 211 is the state's version of that. So it's going to be a web-facing version where someone could essentially dime out a business that might not be enforcing safety standards as well as they should, or as well as the individual thinks they should. So the state will then use that to get in touch with, say, the local Board of Health, which really is the enforcement arm for a lot of these COVID protocols. The state would get the complaint. The complaint would get transferred over to, Town of Barnstable Health Board, and then it would be up to the Town of Barnstable to go and correct or, find out what's going on at the local business. So if someone sees, employees without masks, no real attempt to keep people in line, socially distancing, things like that, this is now a new web-based system, a new website that folks can go to.
That is our State House reporter, Mike Dean, joining us from Beacon Hill. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today, a jam-packed show. I want to thank all my guests, and a big thanks to Dan Tridel back at the studio for pressing all the buttons and moving all the knobs that make the show sound so pretty. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.